We have a sonic bogey to the east, Hauke. Sounds like a sled. If hostile, destroy. If it's someone from the island, they must be turned back. If they refuse, shoot to disable the sled.
Understood. Hauke and Moki on our way.
All right, Gabby, he told the speech-tied Moki. Hauke gave his partner a long, narrow grin.
Let's check it out and watch that trigger.
We're only enforcing a quarantine. We don't shoot at crewmates unless we absolutely have to.
With a neural impulse, he turned his sled motor on. Without looking back, he lifted off from the muddy rise, then accelerated slowly to the east.
Moki watched Hauke head out before turning his sled to follow.
Tempted, tempted. Tempted, Moki, is temptation. Delicious, is.
The sleds dropped, one after another, into the gloom. On a passive sonar screen, there were small blurry dots that drifted slowly past the shadow of the seamount, then disappeared behind it. Kipiru opened his harness's right claw and dropped the portable listening unit. It tumbled down to the soft ooze. He turned to Jillian.
Done and gone, they chase our shadows. They'll not like to catch false prey.
Jillian had expected guards. Several kilometers back, they had left the sled on delayed automatic and swam off to the north and west. By the time the sled started up again, they had circled to within a few hundred yards of the outlook.
Jillian touched Kipiru's flank. The sensitive hide trembled under her hand.
You remember the plan, Kipiru?
Need you ask?
Jillian raised an eyebrow in surprise. A triple upsweep trill and a wavering interrogative click. That was an unusually brief and straightforward reply for Trinary. Kipiru was capable of more subtlety than she had thought.
Of course not, dear bow wave rider. I apologize. I'll do my part, then not worry for a moment about you doing yours.
Kipiru looked at her as if wishing he didn't have to wear a breather. As if he wanted to speak to her in her native language.
Jillian felt some of this in a gentle telepathic touch.
She hugged his smooth gray torso.
You take care, Kipiru. Remember that you're admired and loved. Very much so.
The pilot tossed his head. To swimming or battle. To warning or rescue. To earning your trust.
They dropped over the edge of the bluff and swam quickly for the ship's outer lock. Chapter 48 Takata Jim. It was impossible to rest. Takata Jim envied humans the total unconsciousness they called sleep. When a man lay down for the night, his awareness of the world disappeared, and the nerves to his muscles deactivated. If he did dream, he usually didn't have to participate physically. Even a neo-dolphin couldn't just turn himself off that way. One or the other hemisphere of the brain was always on sentry duty to control his breathing. Sleep, for a Finn, was both a milder and a far more serious thing. He knocked about the captain's stateroom, wishing he could go back to his own smaller cabin. But symbolism was important to the crew he had inherited. His followers needed more than the logic of legality to confirm his command. They needed to see him as the new bull, and that meant living in the style of the former herd leader. He took a long breath at the surface and emitted clicks to illuminate the room in sound images. Brydaki certainly had eclectic tastes. If thee knew what sort of things the former captain had owned, which couldn't stand wetness, and had therefore been stowed away before Streaker landed on Kithrim, the collection that remained was striking. Works by artists of a dozen sentient races lay sealed behind glass cases. Sound stroke photos of strange worlds
and weird, aberrant stars adorned the walls. Breitike's music system was impressive. He had recordings by the thousands, songs and eerie things that made Takata Jim's spine crawl when he played them. The collection of whale ballads was valuable, and a large fraction appeared to have been collected personally. By the desk comm, there was a photo of Crydike with the officers of the James Cook. Captain Helene Alvarez herself had signed it. The famous explorer had her arm over her dolphin exec's broad, smooth back as she and Crydike mugged for the camera. Takata Jim had served on important ships, cargo vessels supplying the Atlast and Calafia colonies, but he had never been on missions like those of the legendary Cook. He had never seen such sights, nor heard such sounds. Until the shallow cluster, until they found dead ships the size of moons. He thrashed his tail in frustration. His flukes struck the ceiling painfully. His breath came heavily. It didn't matter. Nothing that he had done would matter if he succeeded. If he got Streaker away from Kithrop with her crew alive, if he did that, he would have a photo of his own, and the arm on his back would be that of the President of the Confederacy of Earth. A shimmering collection of tiny motes began to collect to his right. The sparkles coalesced into a holographic image a few inches from his eye. "Yes, what is it?" he snapped. An agitated dolphin, harness arms flexing and unflexing, nodded nervously. It was the ship's purser, Suppa.
"Sir, something strange has happened. We weren't sure we should wake you, but..."
Takata Jim found the Finn's underwater anglic almost indecipherable. Suppa's upper register warbled uncontrollably.
"Calm down and talk slowly," he commanded sharply.
The Finn flinched, but made an effort to obey.
I was in the outlock. I heard someone say there was an alert. Quirkapete sent Haoki and Moki after sled sounds.
Why wasn't I informed?"
Suppa recoiled in dismay. For a moment, he appeared too frightened to speak. Takata Jim sighed and kept his voice calm.
"Never mind, not your fault. Go on."
Visibly relieved, Suppa continued.
"A few minutes later, the light on the personnel outlock came on. Wada said he went over, and I paid no heed. But when Life Cleaner and Wormhole Pilot entered..."
Takata Jim spumed. Only dire need to hear Suppa's story without delay prevented him from crashing about the room in frustration.
"Tried to stop them, as you ordered, but Watasetti and Hiska were doing backflips of joy and dashed about fetching for them both."
"Where are they now?" Takata Jim demanded.
"Baskin entered the main bay with Watasetti. Hiska is off, spreading rumors throughout the ship. Kipiro took a sled and breathers and is gone."
"Gone where?"
"Back out," Suppa wailed.
His command of Anglic was rapidly dissolving. Takata Jim took advantage of what composure the purser had left.
"Have Herkapete awaken Dr. Metz. Have Metz meet me at sickbay with three guards. You are to go to the dry wheel dressing room with Sawtooth, and let no one enter. Understood?"
Suppa nodded vigorously, and his image vanished. Takata Jim prayed that Herkapete would have the sense to recall Moki and Haoki and send them after Kipiru. Together, between Haoki's brains and Moki's feral ruthlessness, they might be able to cut the pilot off before he reached the Thenanin wreck. "Why isn't Kathah John back yet? I chose him to go after that middy in order to get him out of the ship for a while. I was afraid he was becoming dangerous even to me. I wanted some time to organize without him around, but now the Baskin woman's returned sooner than I expected. Maybe I should have kept Kathah John around. The giant's talents might be useful about now." Takata Jim whistled the door open and swam out into the hall. He faced a confrontation he had hoped to put off for at least another 40 hours, if not indefinitely. Should I have seen to Krydike before this? It would have been easy. A power failure in his gravity tank, a switched catheter. Metz would not approve, but there was already much Metz did not know. Much that Takata Jim wished he didn't know. He swam hard for the intra-hull lift. Maybe I won't need Cathar John in order to deal with Gillian Baskin, he thought. After all, what can one human female do?
Chapter 49 The Psi-Bomb. The mound of partly dried weeds formed a dome on the sea of vines. Tom had propped up a low roof using salvaged bits of strutting from his sledge, making a rude cave. He sat at the entrance, waiting in the pre-dawn dimness, and munched one of his scarce food bars. His wounds were cleaned as well as possible, and coated with hardening dabs of medicinal foam. With food in his stomach and some of the pain put down, he almost felt human again. He examined his small osmotic still. The upper part, a clear bag with a filtered spout at one end, held a thick layer of salt water and sludge. Below the filter, one of his canteens sat almost filled. Tom looked at his watch. Only 5 minutes remained. There was no time to dip for another load of scummy water to feed the still. He wouldn't even be able to clean the filters before the bomb went off. He picked up the canteen, screwed its cap tight, and slipped it into a thigh pouch. Then he popped the filter out of its frame and shook most of the sludge out, before folding it tightly and tucking it under his belt. The filter probably didn't take all the dissolved metal salts out of the water. It hadn't been designed with Kithrop in mind. Nonetheless, the little package was probably his most valuable possession. 3 minutes, the glowing numbers on his watch told him. Tom looked up at the sky. There was a vague brightening in the east, and the stars were starting to fade. It would be a clear morning, and therefore bitterly cold. He shivered and zipped the wetsuit tight. He pulled in his knees. Again Venus came to mind, perhaps because then, too, his fate and all he cared about had hung upon sending a message. Only there, it had been for succor. Moreover, his enemies had been few and furtive, while all around him friendly humans and aliens had roamed the steaming skies searching for a slender clue he had only to provide. This time matters were reversed. Friends were the scarce commodity, while his signal would be a shout, a scream directed at countless foes. Enemies who at best would willingly rack his body and strain his brain pan for what it contained. Yet he must strive to bring them here, down here, almost to this very spot. How do I keep getting into jams like this? 1 minute. When it came, it would be like the loudest sound he had ever heard, like the brightest light. There would be no keeping it out. He wanted to cover his ears and eyes as if against a real explosion. Instead, he stared at a point on the horizon and counted. Pacing each breath, deliberately he let himself slide into a trance. 7, 8, 9, 10. A lightness filled his chest. The feeling spread outward, numbing and soothing. Light from the few stars in the west diffracted spiderweb rays through his barely separated eyelashes as he awaited a soundless explosion.
Sout, I said I'm ready to take over now.
Sout squirmed and looked up at Toshio.
Just another few minutes, okay? I'm listening to something.
Toshio frowned. This was not what he had expected from Sout. He had come to relieve the dolphin linguist early because Sout hated working with the robot probe.
What's going on, Tosh?
Denny sat up in her sleeping bag, rubbing her eyes, peering in the pre-dawn dark.
I offered to take over the robot so Sout wouldn't have to deal with Charlie when he calls, but he refuses to let go.
Denny shrugged.
Then I'd say that's his business.
What do you care, anyway?
Toshio felt a sharp answer rise to his lips, but he kept them locked and turned away. He would ignore Denny until she wakened fully and decided to behave civilly.
This ends side one of cassette 7.